Wednesday, May the 7th, year 2003. We are here in McAllen, Texas, the office of Jesse Trevino. This can be our interviewee today for the Bracero Oil 50 project at the University of Texas at El Paso. Jesse, tell us when and where were you born?
I was born in Alice, Texas, in 1925, December the 25th.
Okay, and did you grow up there?
I grew up in Alice and graduated from high school there in 1944.
Okay, can you tell us how you were involved with the Bracero program?
The reason I got involved in the Bracero program back in 51 when I was just was going to get married about that time, so I remember the date very well. It's 1951, October. And I found out through a friend of mine in Austin that Dr. George I. Sanchez, who was a professor at the University of Texas at that time, was looking for a Mexican-American to apply for the job of compliance officer, people that would go out and see that the Bracero contract between the worker and the farmer or the American rancher would be complied with, and he wanted us to apply for it, and I did, and I got the job as a compliance officer. They sent me to Harlingen and San Benito area after signing up with them in Dallas, Texas. That's where the U.S. Department of Labor was located at.
How did you find that out
about
the job?
About the job through a friend of mine who this Dr. Sanchez had asked him to apply, or someone like him, you know, and he wanted people from the university. And I had been at the University of Texas. I'm a graduate of the University of Texas, a class of 50 in business, and I was very familiar with Dr. Sanchez. We had honored him and several other outstanding Mexican-Americans in that area at that time, attorney Gus Garcia and others. And so we were very active in civil rights programs at the University of Texas at the time that we attended there.
Okay. So what was the training to be?
There was no training at that time. The only thing you learn is what the contract specified, and the contract was very specific as to what between the worker and the employer. What it was is that the employer had to pay a certain amount of money for processing of these braceros. I don't remember the exact amount of money, but it wasn't very much. I think it was $7 or $11 or something like that per person. And then the grower would have to agree that he would do certain things for the worker. First of all, he would pay a minimum wage. So that at that time, it was, I think, 35 cents an hour, and then it went up to 50 cents, and they thought they were going to go broke. You know, and then they had piece rate wages that they paid, like in cotton, it would be by the weight of the cotton, or in other sugar beets, another thing like that would be, I guess, by the amount of sugar beets or other things that they picked up, you know. But for a lot of them that did just standard work and the fee or something like that, they would be paid a minimum wage. At the time, I think it was around 50 cents an hour. That was pretty standard at that time. The other thing that they furnished, I may add, to the contract, is that they had to furnish them with an insurance, a health insurance, where if Bracero got sick, they had about 500. They would furnish the health insurance, like I said, that they one of them was for health insurance, which was around $500 that would pay anybody getting sick of a cold or something like that. And then the other was if they got hurt while they're working. That's a difference. And then they had a life insurance policy also.
Did they do that for the braceros themselves?
Yes, sir. For the braceros themselves. They had to furnish that. Yes, sir. That was part of the contract. And they would both sign, and they would be great. As a result of that, you can imagine there was quite a bit of a racket going on. Like on Sundays or weekends when they weren't working, some of these truckers that used to haul them into the fields and things would make a deal with the doctor and take a whole truckload of braceros to a doctor in Raymondville or some of those isolated places where they didn't have very much business. And by golly, they got to have a whole bunch of patients there that they wouldn't normally have. So the insurance company had to kind of look into those things. And
okay, so what was your job?
My job.
Where was it located?
My job at the beginning was that I had an office in San Benito at the Aztec building there. It had a city hall, and I think they furnished that seat to the Labor Department. And then they had a Bracero Center in Harlingen. And there they processed these braceros to go work here in the field and also to receive them whenever they terminated their contract or they're returning to Mexico. So I worked those places and worked very closely. And my job was to see that if any of the contracts were violated by the farmer, that I would go out and see that the farmer got a fair. In other words, I would see that the contract was fulfilled. I mean, the Mexican consul would represent the worker, and I, as a compliance officer, would represent the farmer. And then between us, we would decide whether any money was owed or whatever the contract, whatever was violated in the contract was complied with. And that was my job, to see that there, if not, they would blackball them and take the braceros away from them if we didn't see fit to them.
So you're involved more with the farmers than the actual braceros themselves?
No, but with both, because the braceros would complain to us, and then we'd report it to the Mexican consul, and as a result of that, then we would have to investigate, both of us. And usually with the consul, I would, in most cases, like in Harlingen, in San Benito, the Mexican consul in Brownsville, Perez Abreu was his name, he was a full consul there, he and I would sit down and listen to both stories of the farmer and the worker, and then we'd let him out, and then he and I were either, you know, we were both jury, judge, and everything else, and we'd decide who would owe what money, you know, and I would take the grower aside and say, you got to pay him so much, and if the worker, the consul would talk to him and say, look, Juan, this is what we decided that you have coming, and if the worker said, no, I don't want it, I said, well, all right, Juan, you don't have to accept that this will be filed and sent to Dallas. They'll send an investigator, and then we'll send the money. If any money is collected, or more money, then we'll send it to Mexico, and then you'll get it at your ranch. He said, no, I'll take the money right now. So usually we would settle that case, you know, pretty rapidly. And we had good relationships. The Mexican consul and I, you know, were very fair. We played poker every Saturday night and all that. And usually when he got through discussing, and would dismiss the grower and the worker, one time he took out the drawer right here and gave me a bottle of scotch, you know, because you used to get all the liquor there pretty cheap. I think it was $22 a case. And he said, you worked pretty hard for it, Jesse. Here, give us a bottle of scotch, you know. So, like I say, we never had any difficulties, and most of the time we would be able to comply, you know, with the law.
Now, you work for what department?
The Labor Department. The Labor Department, yes, Labor. Yes, yeah, Department of Labor, yeah.
Okay. And you said, you mentioned your office was in Harlingen and
in San Benito, yeah. I had an office in San Benito, really, was my official office, but the Bracero Center is where a lot of complaints, when these braceros were returned, they would have complaints against somebody in Arkansas, and there were compliance officers over there in Arkansas that would investigate and do that thing.
So the braceros knew where these officers were at?
Oh, yeah, yeah. They knew. They had to say, in the contract, they'd tell them where they could complain about anything that mistreatment, like they were supposed to for example, furnish the worker with utensils. I mean, in other words, frying pans and boil water and all the basic things, you know, spoon and things like that, and knife and fork and things. And then that way they could be able to cook, you know. And they also to furnish them with a bed, clean bed, and bunks, you know, and bunk beds and things like that at a reasonable rate. And they also were to be transported from the Bracero Center to its designation, either Arkansas, here in Texas, or wherever.
Did you actually physically go out to the field and check out the living conditions?
Yes, sometimes when there were complaints, yes. Uh-huh. We never went out unless we were told to investigate certain things, the violations that were reported to the Mexican consul. Uh-huh. And there were not too many. Most of them complied. They knew what they had to do. One of the advantages of the Vocera program that a lot of our farmers and growers that live here in the border had wetbacks, you know. And what they did after they learned the system of the Vocera program, they would send their wetbacks over to Monterey. They get contracted, and then the Vocero would have a chance to pick the employee he wanted. He could reject anybody he wanted, and then the grower had the same privilege. So when they came into the Vocera program, I mean, Joe Blow over here that used to hire him as a wetback would pick the Vocero, the wetback that he had before, and then, you know, he would take him with him. And he wouldn't have to train him or anything. He would already be broken in, you know.
And yeah, he'd be legal now.
He would be legal now, and nobody could touch him. And you got to remember, in those days, there were a lot of wetbacks. I remember one incident of a grower that's name is Frank Russell. I don't know if when you go down to Brownsville from Harlingen, you turn at Russelltown to go to Port Isabel and to the island. So this is a thing that... this man used to have so many wetbacks that were caught by the immigration that they were taken by the busload out, and then they have to wait to fill up another bus, you know, full of people, and would give them soda waters to the immigration there while they're waiting to get the second load off the hand. But it was a very good program to really make it all where the worker would have a protection and some kind of rights. And so went back, he had none, right. You know, and so it was, I think, a program that it wouldn't be bad to look at it even now.
So, yeah, you mentioned about the insurance, mm-hmm. and so the farmer or, you know, whoever hired the federal had to purchase the insurance?
Right. They'd sell it there at the Bracero Center. So there was different companies. I worked. After I left the Labor Department, I mean, I worked for an insurance company that used to, you know, handle the Vocera program. I used to, let me just give you a little history, if I may. I mean, the Vocera program in Harlingen was closed. I mean, there because of budgets or I don't know whatever reasons, was closed. And so I was transferred from the Valley to El Paso. And El Paso, they had the Vocera centers here in the Valley, in Harlingen. They had some in Eagle Pass, and then they had some in El Paso, and then in California. So they switched me from here, from the Valley.
What year was that in?
That was around 52, 53, because my daughter was born over there, and it was 53. And because she was, it was 52, you know, thereabouts.
In El Paso.
And then I worked out of El Paso for a number of months, about 6 or 8 months. And then they opened up the Vocera Center here at the border, right here at Hidalgo. And then that's where a lot of people like Ray, that you interviewed today, you told me, Chapa, and others worked there at the Vocera Center here in Hidalgo. And it was the same thing that they had in Bronx in Harlingen, but here it was closer to the border. They could just walk across, you know, the bridge there. And it was immigration that was involved in bringing in these people here legally. And then there was the health, U.S. Health Department also, who examined them for TB and other disease like that. And, of course, the Labor Department who handled the contract.
I understand they also, they fumigate them also?
Some of them were fumigated. I mean, they put some kind of thing, but I don't remember seeing too many of that. But they did have some of that. Yeah.
They also kill us, like
lights and things like that. Uh-huh. Yeah. But there you had two differences. At the Vocera Center, you had immigration who handled some, and then you have the other that handled the other thing like that.
Okay.
Okay.
What were the buildings like there?
The building was barracks type thing that where they processed these fellows there, and it was pretty hot there, no air conditioning or anything, you know, and they had a whole bunch of people typing out these different documents that they did for immigration, like some that I've seen in this pamphlet here, the identification that they had. And it seemed to me that one of the things that happened with this program is that a lot of these people that came here were not agriculture people. They were waiters or other things like that that weren't used to this thing of picking cotton or being in the sun. And after I left the Labor Department, I worked for this insurance company that sold Bracetto Insurance. We had quite a few deaths of sunstrokes, you know, people that were not used to this really hot weather that we have here. And as a result, the insurance company would have to pay quite a bit of money. I mean, quite a bit of money in those days was a few thousand dollars, but still, sunstroke would pay for death, you know, in the field. So that was working, you know. So
to the family.
To the family of the Bracetto, you know, that they would handle that. And the other thing that happened is that a lot of these Braceros were not accustomed to being away from the families. And they went kind of batty. I mean, in other words, they went crazy. And the guys would pick on them, too, among their own Braceros, you know. And they would have to do something with them. And the county jail didn't want them. The city jail didn't want them. So I finally made arrangements when I was working for the insurance company to take these fellows an ambulance to take them to the border here at Hidalgo. And then somebody from, I went to Monterey, and the Mexican consul and I made the arrangement to where we could pick them up over here and take them to Monterey. And that way they would get longer treatment over there because of the money differences that would be involved in paying a hospital or wherever we keep them. So we did that quite a bit to where that would help the Bracetto and would help us, you know, to do something with the problem that we had that nobody really wanted them, you know, and have them.
You say they went kind of... But not crazy, but
they lost their senses, and then I think one of the things that I think happened is that a lot of these fellow workers would pick on them, that their wives were stepping out on them and all that kind of stuff, and they were kind of weak about that, and you can imagine that they've never been away from it. The other thing that developed in this thing is a lot of these grocery stores, small grocery stores, would make our deal, and there were all kinds of rackets going on in this Bracetto program, in the sense that you had the insurance company, you have the contractors, that people from Arkansas didn't want to come all the way to contract somebody, so they would authorize this particular contractor to say, hey, you get me 1,000 Bracettos over there. And they charge them $1 or $2 a head, I mean, per person. And then they would furnish the food, you know, and they make sandwiches and then in little bags, brown bags, you know, and it would give them in the way. And then they put them in trailers, on these cattle trailers that you have, you know, I mean, they put them in there, and they would go all the way to Arkansas. And they would find a rest stop somewhere in between, and then they'd go on. And it was a racket, I mean, where even some braceros were lost overnight. I know this Frank Russell that I told you about lost braceros overnight, and they were recontracted to somebody in Arkansas. So it was, you know, it was a big thing going on all over the place.
And you said you also had compliance officer in
Arkansas? Yes, they would communicate with us, and we'd communicate with them, you know, in time. But they would handle any claims in that particular area of any farmers or growers that they had over there. Yeah. So it was...
And you said the employers would come personally to the
centers? Most of them would send, or they would authorize someone to be the representatives here, you know, that they have, you know.
Okay, after the contract was over with?
They would return them to the center.
They would actually come back and return them to the contract?
Yes,
that
would be. Now, if the man could not fulfill his contract, he would have to pay the unexpired of the contract, you know, up to
who
the farmer would have to. Let's say he contracted him for 6 weeks or 2 months or something like that, and he couldn't have work for just 1 month. He would have to pay 3/4 of, you know, of the contract that was left, you know. But most of the time, if that man was recontracted, he wouldn't owe anything. You know, I remember I settled one claim with this Frank Russell, that they gave me a bill of $60,000 that he owed. At that time, $60,000 was quite a bit of money. And I went over to knock on his door, and I said, Mr. Russell, I didn't know, the man was quite a character. He says, I've come over here to help you. I said, I understand that you owe $60,000 in back pay that you didn't fulfill your contract with some Bracetto. He said, no, that's not right. I said, well, can come in and let me help you, see if I can clear this up. If these Bracetto were recontracted at the center, we have records whether they were recontracted. You don't know any money. If they went back to Mexico, you don't know any money because they weren't here to fulfill the contract. So he gave me his records. I went to the center, and I checked it out, and he didn't have to pay a dime because all of them, most of them, had been recontracted to other workers, and some of these contractors that were here that were being paid a few bucks per each person, you know, were making money and don't know that. But maybe they didn't ship any from Monterey, and there was just to be some braceros that were needed up there. So he would contract them and get these braceros to go over there. And he was very grateful, and he gave us a big party at the Mexican consul and me and everybody else, you know, for helping him save that kind of money.
So at the centers and the braceros were coming in, you weren't really involved in the day-to-day activity of
the only time I was involved was in El Paso, where they let everybody go because they didn't have the new budget, and they had no money in the Labor Department to pay us. So they left me and another fellow at that time. They let everybody go because there was no money to pay them. And I would have to receive them and send them to Juarez and you know, going that way. But that's the only time. But most of the time, others would take care of that in the center.
What were your normal working hours?
There were no hours, really. When they were here, there was you could be called just any time. 24 hours, you know, a day, and they could be in Raymondville here. And I stopped. When I was here in the Valley, I really just worked the Valley. I didn't work Arkansas or any of those places. I just kept, my base was here in Hidalgo. At that time, I just had, one of the things that I may add here too, there was a lot of politics involved. That's when Eisenhower was in president, and he sent a whole bunch of Republicans from Tennessee, Georgia. They didn't even know what a Mexican looked like. They could not speak Spanish. They didn't know what they were. They just sat around. There was a political term that was given to them. There was a lot of discrimination among the, at that time. For example, I was the only one there with a degree and experience and all that, and I never got advanced. You know, I mean, I kept the same level of salary and stature and everything else. And others that came from Georgia and up in there, they had positions higher than us, making more money, and they were just hillbilly. I mean, you could tell that they weren't educated, they were not up to par, you know, but they were hired because of some political guy over there recommended over here, and they were hired. So I finally left because of that, that I didn't see any future, and this insurance company hired me, and all I did was just to try to get the accounts for the different independent agents.
How long did you work with
the braceros? Oh, about 2-3 years, something like that. Yeah.
And what years were those, do you recall?
Oh, from 51 to 52, 53, 54. But 55, something like that. 54.
That was year-round, right?
Year-round. Yeah.
So you were like a DS worker?
DS worker, yeah. Something like DS-7 or something like that. I was earning about 4,200 or 4,800, something thereabouts, you know, that I was getting at that time. But I never got an increase. I mean, I just kept the same salary.
Uh-huh.
And I was making more money with the insurance company, you know, after I left them. And that's how I got into the insurance business that I'm in now. I've been at it for 45 years.
Do you recall any problems with ourselves, like labor unrest?
Yeah, there were some strikes. I went over and to Raymondville one time where they had gone on strike. They didn't want to pick cotton or something like that, and I finally talked them into picking cotton, you know,
Why were they on
strike? They were on strike because you had one or two in there that were leaders, you know, and tried to get more money for themselves than what they were supposed to get, and they had no choice but to follow the contract as to what it said there, you know. It specified there that if you're going to do cotton, you're going to be paid so much a pound, and if you're going to do something else, you're going to be paid by the hour, so much, so... There really wasn't anything to strike about. I mean, they had agreed to that particular amount. Now, some of these farmers treated them extra well. I know one farmer in Raymondville, that Mr. Astley Downing, who actually had, you got to remember, TV was very, very at that time, 1951, there was hardly anybody had TVs. This man went out and bought, I don't know how many TVs, so the service could watch the TV, and they would, they were in the barracks, so they had them, you know, they had TVs, and I don't know how many TVs he bought. He had some, he hadn't even unloaded, you know. And so this man was quite a character. He was talking to his, one of his workers there at the gym. He had a gym there in Raymondville. And he said, no, next year, I said, we're going to make this place for the Braceros good, but nice place, you know, and everything. I'll have TVs for them, and we're going to put some sort of Coke machines up in there. And then one of the assistants there said, Mr. Bannon, I don't think we want to put any machine, anybody in there, because the Braceros would get.
Okay, what were the advantages and disadvantages of the Bracero program, and what do you think contributed to the program's demise, and do you think should be reinstated?
Well, I think the advantages were that we had enough help here to take care of our crops, you know, at that time. You got to remember, at that time when it started, there was a war going on, the World War II, and we had to have some crops harvested and everything else, and everybody was being drafted, I mean, you know. And I served three years myself in the Air Force. And so it was a good program at the time, and I think after it served its purpose, I think we began to have some labor organizers, I mean, in California and here in Texas and other places, that felt that they were taking the place of their own U.S. workers over here in the field, or working for less. But I think the program was a great advantage to have at that particular time. And even now, where you don't have as many workers going out in the field, or haven't liked to go work in the field like they used to have, like I remember in the old days, you used to have thousands and thousands of crew workers that would take people from here, from the valley, to Colorado and Michigan and everywhere else, you know, migrants. And we still have some, but not as many as we did then. I think now it might be a program that, if it was put together on a different way, I mean, to where they would not displace any of our own local people here, there would be a good program to look at and to see if it would work. I think it, both Mexico and us would be, because we're spending thousands and thousands of dollars now picking up, and then there's a whole bunch of people that die, I mean, coming over here, crossing the different deserts and the Kenya and all those places where you find them. I think that if we had some kind of a program to where we could make it easier for some of these people to come over here and work here, and then keep a tab on them where they're at, and not have to spend all that money in hauling them back, because they're going to come over. I mean, if you're in need of work or money or something like that, you're going to make the sacrifice, and even your life, I mean, that you're going to cross the river somewhere or another. So I believe if we could have a program to where you could bring them over under a supervised deal, to where the immigration would be involved and the health department would be involved, and they would come in under a restricted deal, to where they could be kept tabs on, to where they would know. Now with the computers and everything we have now, I don't see why they couldn't keep tab on a lot of those people. And I think the program would work now if it was to be brought into this program here. And we have both nations.
Yeah, I know they were looking at it, you know, before the 9/11 thing.
Yeah. They were studying that.
Then
it fell apart because of the 9/11. But the people that came over here didn't cause any problems. Oh, yes, they would have their night at the cantina and, you know, anything like that. But you never heard of any robberies. You never heard of any murders or anything like that. It was a very good program at that time. You know, it just never did cause serious problems in most communities where these people were at. And it helped the community a lot. I mean, a lot of those... They were spending money here, spending, you know, a lot of clothing and other things like that they would spend in the grocery stores. And I know a lot of little grocery stores that they had. Now, one racket that they had is that they had to go to a particular store, and they'll give them coupons and things like that, and that we stopped that, you know, because we didn't allow that. I mean, in other words, they could not have a control. They pay the workers, and they can go buy or you know, buy their things, their goods, their food and things, whatever they want to.
Yeah.
And we didn't allow them to have a control and by just spending the money with a particular grocery store. But other than that, you know, it worked out. It helped, you know, transporting and housing and everything else.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Mr. Trevino, for your
interview. It's a pleasure doing that.
And work it there at the
Well, good. Well, thank you. Well, I might go over there and listen to it one of these days.